Welcome to Sauce Secrets, a Vela Wood podcast where we take you behind the bar and deep into the world of the Texas alcohol manufacturing industry. I'm your host, Clark Smith, a partner at Vela Wood. Each episode, we sit down with a trailblazer behind Texas's favorite drinks to dive into their personal journeys, career-defining moves, and the key business decisions that set them apart. Whether you're an aspiring alcohol entrepreneur or just love a good business success story, you'll get insider knowledge on what it takes to thrive in this competitive industry right here in Texas. So pour yourself a glass and let's uncover the sauce secrets. Welcome back to another episode of Sauce Secrets, Vela Wood's podcast series on the Texas alcohol manufacturer and the trials and tribulations of being a small business owner in this industry. I'm so excited to be working with my good friend Jeremiah Allen today from High Horse Triple Sec. Jeremiah brings a very unique set of background skills and experiences to the podcast and is at a really critical and interesting point in the business that he's running, which is High Horse Triple Sec. He's based here in Austin, but he's got presence all over the state. I wanted to hand it over to Jeremiah if you can just give us some brief background and intro and let you take it from here.
All right. Thanks, Clark. Thanks for having me first. I'm really excited about doing a podcast. This is my first, especially about High Horse. So as far as background, I was born in Bowie, Texas. I grew up kind of North Texas, went to school for RTF, radio, television, film. I moved to Austin after my mom actually brought me to Austin, me and a friend, for a weekend for my 21st birthday. And after that weekend, I was like, this is where I got to live.
I love it.
And then got a job at Fox 7 to help me move here. That was the reason to move here. And then got a job at Treasure Island bartending on the weekends to pay the bills and quickly became my full-time profession was bartending on 6th Street. Bartended on 6th Street for 7 or 8 years, Treasure Island, Platinum X, Jogging Monkey, Blind Pig Pub, some of the classics. I met my wife at Blind Pig Pub. Eventually kind of got out of bartending, got into finance, got my MBA at Texas State, was doing finance for startups since then. So that's been 10 or so years. And then, well, I don't want to get ahead of myself, the yeehaw moment.
Yeah, no, let's hear it. I want to hear about the, we've been calling it the aha moment, but for you, I think it fits even better. What was the yeehaw moment for High Horse Triple Sec?
So I had always worked in bars and restaurants and even in college. My first bartending job was at Applebee's in Sherman, Texas. And it was during COVID and I had went to Twin Liquor on Burnett Road to get margarita supplies. And looking for tequila, I just noticed how many Texas-themed or crafted spirits there are and where they were on the shelf and how like 512 Tequila, you know, Republic Tequila that actually has a shape of Texas, they had great placement on the shelf, kind of eye level, closer to the front of the store. And I was like, that's really interesting. And then I noticed some other brands. And then went over to the orange liqueur aisle for Triple Sec and noticed there was nothing like that there. Everything, Grand Marnier, Cointreau, the super high-end French orange liqueurs, or the cheap Triple Sec on the bottom shelf. And just noticed there was no, what I felt like there should be a Texas presence. And that was it. I went home and told my wife, who's a corporate attorney, the idea. I was like, there needs to be a Texas-branded Triple Sec. We make countless numbers of margaritas in Texas. Where's the Texas Triple Sec? And she said, that makes sense. And that doesn't sound like a booming backup, but for my corporate attorney, whose job it is to tell me when ideas are bad, it was great. This is a good idea.
Well, an attorney's no alcohol. So
right. And so with that support, I just started digging into it. And, you know, what is Triple Sec?
What I wanted to ask you. Before we really dive into the details of the business, I'm sure we're going to have some people listening that wonder, I've heard of it, but what is Triple Sec?
What's funny is I get asked this when I do tastings at liquor stores. People walk past and I'm like, hey, you want to try some Texas made Triple Sec? And they're like, Triple Sec? And it's always kind of a question mark. You're sampling Triple Sec? And I always knew it was an orange liqueur, but, you know, kind of digging into it. So Triple Sec is translated to triple dry in French. Sec means dry in French. And the idea is that to make an orange liqueur, you would take some kind of base spirit, mix it with orange flavors, either synthetic or real oranges or natural, and then sugar. So to be a liqueur, it has to have a certain amount of sugar. And then to make a triple sec, you would take that mixture and distill it a few more times, and that dries it out, usually takes the color out, takes some of the sweetness out, some of the other impurities, and then you have triple sec. So it should be drier than other orange liqueurs. So when I had the idea, I bought all the orange liqueurs, which I still have a full cabinet of orange liqueurs in my house. And I was blown away at how, like, the cheap ones that say triple sec, they're like sub $10, how super syrupy and sweet they are. And from what I've learned, the reason they do that is to kind of mask the inferior base spirit. So it's just a cheap liqueur. And then even on the high end, like for Cointreau, used to say triple sec on the bottle. And they took it off years ago, and I think just from the stigma of triple sec. But it's even sweet. So my vision immediately was it needs to be dry. People are moving away from margaritas and getting more ranch waters because they're too sweet. And so let's make something drier that, you know, what I think is a classic triple sec or a traditional triple sec.
All right, I love it. So you've got the yeehaw moment. Mm-hmm. You're figuring out what triple sec is. How'd you get from there to where we are right now?
Even from the beginning, I had no, like, I don't want to go out and raise millions of dollars and build a distillery. So I started kind of digging in. Once I had a flavor profile that I liked, my first thought was there's tons of these independent distilleries in Texas, and surely one of them has idle time where they can make some bottles of triple sec on the side. And I reached out to a lot, and I did not get a lot of emails back or phone calls back. And I got a little discouraged. And then eventually I found one south of Houston who emailed me back and was like, "We think this is a great idea. We think we could do a good job. Let's talk." And so we started talking. They have their own in-house brand, but they also have a small contract bottling arm that they were trying to build. And so basically that means that they're making other brands that aren't theirs, kind of a, you know, distiller for hire. And so we met, I told them the flavor I was going for, and they're like, "Let us work on it. We'll come back to you." And so they came back to me a month later with some samples. And even from that first sample, I was like, "This is great." It wasn't exactly what I wanted. And we ended up going back and forth for months to finally tweak it to the final product. But I was blown away by how just the first pass was so great. And it was at that time, that was kind of like the second aha moment. Like, I went the whole way back from Houston, I was calling creative people, and my wife is a lawyer, like, "Let's get the contracts ready," because I knew I could move forward and make this happen. So the whole, like, contract bottling made a lot of sense to me because I wouldn't have to go out and raise money. I'd owned a restaurant for 5 years prior to that, and it was open for 5 years. It was called Man Bites Dog. It was like a gourmet hot dog restaurant. And eventually I had to close the doors because we were just breaking even. Our lease was up. But it broke my heart to tell the investors, you know, "I'm not going to be able to give your money back." And they're like, "We understand, you know, you worked really hard," but it still, it hurt me to my core. Like, I didn't letting them down. And so I did not like the idea of having to go out and raise money for an unproven product. And so doing the contract bottling route meant that I could get it off the ground and prove the concept before raising money.
Absolutely. I think, you know, if we had had this conversation 10 or 12 years ago, we wouldn't have been having this conversation, because I just think contract distilling, co-packing, it was hardly even a thing back then. It's becoming more and more prevalent. It seems to me to be a really cogent, viable option for the startups looking to get into market, get on shelves without having to do seven figures worth of capital costs and fundraising. I would say, I mean, you tell me, but I bet 20% to a quarter of startup alcohol manufacturers in Texas are probably co-packing. It could be way more than that.
I agree. I'm not sure. And some of the distilleries I've talked to kind of since then, I've met more, and like startup distilleries are like, "We have idle time and it only takes us so long to make our product." And then our distillers are just sitting there. So it's a good second revenue stream for them. But then for like guys like me, it's a good way to start your brand. But I definitely think it's growing. And I think it has to, is because you look at the shelves, there's so many brands out there. There's no way there's, you know, the equivalent of that many distilleries in Texas.
So Jeremiah, I wouldn't say that you guys are at an early, early stage of the business, but you're also maybe not even quite mid-stage. You're in that interesting go-between, but you're close enough to the launch that you can talk about how it was that you were able to lean on friends and family in ways that is maybe atypical. You weren't getting checks from your uncle or your cousins, but you were still working with them in order to help get the business off the ground. Talk about that.
Yeah, so I wanted to keep my costs as lean as possible until we got out there on the shelf. And so I've done finance and accounting. I've done some creative work, so I kind of knew what I wanted. But I was very lucky in that, you know, the label on a spirit is half the battle. Like if people don't like the label, it's just going to sit on the shelf. My brother-in-law and his wife have a company called Creative Pickle here in Austin. They do websites and brand identity, that kind of stuff. And they were super excited to work on it because they usually do websites for law firms and accounting firms. Not that that's not fun, but this was their one of their first spirits brands. So they got really excited. And so they were going to specs and looking at different labels coming back. So, you know, because they were in the family, I got the family discount, but they were also just passionate about the product because it was part of the family. So that was super helpful. My wife is a corporate attorney, a badass corporate attorney, and she did all my legal work, which was great. I was able to do a lot of the sourcing, a lot of the research. So I was just able to keep it really lean and keep it self-funded because I just didn't love the idea of going out and raising a bunch of money in the beginning. So getting it off the ground, and like I mentioned, having those previous relationships with people in the bar industry helped me kind of kick it off the ground. Once it got out in the market, normally where you would spend, you know, your marketing dollars, I guess it kept building it up too. But that has been the toughest, one of the toughest parts for me is how to spend marketing dollars. So I talked to some of the Deep Eddy guys and the idea of billboards came up. And like, you know, you see liquor brands on billboards. He's like, unless you're in every liquor store within 5 miles of that billboard, don't be on that billboard. Because you're not going to leave a liquor store and go look for your brand somewhere else. So that made a lot of sense to me. And it was like, spend all your money on salespeople. That's where your money should be. Salespeople are hard because for me, to hire a salesperson now would be an investment because they're not going to pay for themselves because they're starting from scratch. They're not being handed a portfolio of accounts that they have to maintain. It's like you have to go out and build new accounts, like start from scratch. So that's what I've been doing. And I'd rather spend my money going to these bars and restaurants and supporting them, not only going in during the day and talking and trying to sell into a place, but going at night and buying drinks and buying shots for people and supporting those bartenders. Because I feel like to me, the best thing is building champions of your brand, and the bartenders are it. Like even if they leave that bar and go somewhere else, they know your brand and they'll bring it with them. So even to date, my spending on marketing and advertising is pretty low. My wife says that I have a unique collection of skills that have served me well in this endeavor. One, I did RTF in college, so I do all my own social media, just the editing videos and all that kind of stuff. I was in finance, so that helped. I know bartenders, that helped. So it's been a really good fit for me, and it's been super fun.
No, I think you've identified what you're good at, and you've been running with it. So job well done. Let's talk about getting those products onto shelves. You have obviously, as an alcohol manufacturer, you can't go bring the product straight to a package store or to a bar or restaurant. Talk about your relationship with your wholesaler. Any advice, any key decisions that you've made along the way?
You know, even though I bartended for a long time, I had no idea how this side worked. I knew how to pour drinks and serve drinks, but I did not know how the supplier, wholesaler, distributor, four-tier Texas system. I didn't know any of that. I had to learn all that as I went. So once we had a viable product, I knew I needed a distributor. That was the next step. And so I found a local distributor who I just emailed randomly and said, I have this product I'm working on. It's going to be ready in a few months. Would you be interested in talking about it? And they responded, they're like, yeah, we love Texas products. I think it'd be a good fit. And so I was like, great. I checked that off a list of to-dos that I have a distributor now. So I was like, I'm ready to go. And then once we were ready and we had product and we had cases to ship, I started going out to try to sell it to liquor stores. And even if I made a great pitch and they're like, yeah, we think this would be great. We'd love to carry it. Who's your distributor? And I would tell them. And every time I would get a, we don't like them. And I'd be like, oh, why? You know, what's the problem? They're like, well, and it was a handful of reasons. They didn't like the catalog or they didn't like their delivery or they didn't have stock for whatever reason. And then I was like, I thought I was screwed. I was like, well, what am I gonna do now? And I was like, I'm just gonna have to power through and like lift this distributor up with my brand by, you know, being one of their best products. And luckily, I was in King Liquor randomly and the owner introduced me to a sales rep for another Texas distributor that had a much better reputation. And they were looking for a new orange liqueur, and the timing just worked out perfectly. And we started talking, and I was able to move to a new distributor.
For the record, the owner of King Liquor introduced me and Jeremiah as well, somewhat randomly. I don't think it was the same occurrence at King Liquor, But yeah, Sam over at King is a good friend of both of ours.
They're in my neighborhood, and they were the first liquor store to carry High Horse, so I owe them a lot.
You owe them a lot. No, yeah. They're fantastic. I've learned a ton about the package store business from Sam. So you mentioned the fourth tier, right? So Texas is unique. The wholesaler can't go and sell distilled spirits directly to the bar or restaurant. Has to go through a package store. You talk about that dynamic and your experience of having to not just market your product to package stores, but also then trying to find the package stores, getting it onto bar and restaurant shelves.
So I was lucky in the beginning that some of the people that I used to bartend with on 6th Street now own bars and restaurants. And so I'd been talking to them about bringing in High Horse when it was ready. And so once we had launched and had bottles ready, they were able to put in enough orders for the specs to bring it in. And so that kind of jumpstart that process. And I always looked at it as I needed to be on premise in restaurants and bars so people can see it on menus and on shelves so that before focusing on liquor stores. And that would drive the people to go to liquor stores and say, hey, do you have High Horse?
Absolutely.
Yeah. So that was my kind of goal. So I always focused on restaurants and bars first. But it's tough. And I thought I would have, and I guess I do have a leg up because being in bars and restaurants for so long, I know not to go in on Friday. I know not to go in first thing Monday morning, not to go in the middle of lunch. I know that the person bartending may not be the decision maker. Like there's going to be a bar manager. And having bartended, like I remember sales guys coming in, like reps, and like, I just wanted to disappear, like go hide in the walk-in until they were gone. Go to see when I talk to them. So I'm very conscious of that. So when I go in, I make a point to try to go sit at the bar, introduce myself, take some time, order lunch, try to let them get to know me and me get to know them before I try to pitch them. And it usually works out much better. It's much bigger time commitment than just walking in and being like, can I talk to the bar manager? Because usually you just get kind of shooed away. Sure. So it's proven it takes longer, but it makes a bigger difference.
Talk about a little bit about the dynamic of being a brand owner who utilizes the co-packing contract distilling arrangement. Talk about ownership of obviously the brand, the intellectual property, and how you see that playing differently than, let's say, the person that's actually graining the spirits and making it themselves.
Sure. I mean, I believe that some people get into this because they believe they can make a great product. They're like, I've been doing some home distilling, or I was a brewer. Like, I believe I can make a great product, and that's what I want to focus on, and that's what I want to be proud of. For me, like, I wanted to have a great product that I could promote and sell and get out there and talk about and support. Of course, I wanted it to be well made with great ingredients, but the actual, like, being in the distillery, like, making it myself was not the draw for me. So the contract bottling made a lot of sense because, like I said, with the restaurant, like, all these costs and labor costs and produce going bad and avocados going bad. And it just drove me crazy. With this, like, I have one product that I have to go sell and it doesn't go bad. And, you know, I know once I don't have to worry about ketchup costs, you know, once I've get my costs in line, I'm good to go.
Jeremiah, I want to talk a little bit more about the approach to go with co-packing contract distilling as opposed to actually distilling and rectifying the product yourself. It seems like it's working out pretty well for High Horse. Any pitfalls, any changes of direction you would have made in hindsight?
When I got into it, I loved the idea of contract bottling because I could ease into it, knowing that if the brand became really successful, I could open a distillery or build a distillery later and kind of graduate to that. It kept my costs low in the beginning, less startup costs, but I do pay, you know, a decent co-packing fee for every bottle, and a distillery that's doing their own brand wouldn't have to pay, but they have to pay, you know, all the startup costs for a distillery. So the way to get into the nitty gritty, the way it works is they are making High Horse. My distributor orders it from them and pays them for the product. Once the distillery recoups their fees for making it, their co-packing fee, what's left over is mine. That's my income. So I never own the bottles. So they go from the supplier to the distributor. So my title would be more of a sales guy than it is, you know, a distiller, which I like. And I also, the idea of building a distillery just to make triple sec seemed a little crazy. You know, if we knock it out of the park and we make other types of orange liqueur or other kinds of liqueurs, then absolutely it can make a lot of sense, especially on a smaller scale. But to start and where we are now, it made total sense. And I don't have, you know, a certain amount I have to make every month to cover expenses. So if I want to go on vacation for a month, not that I ever would, I can, and I don't have to worry about paying rent on the distillery.
Any ambitions to scale up the product?
There's part of me that really loves the Tito's model, where we have one brand, one label, and we just do it really well, and everyone knows it. On the other hand, it would be nice to, like, I have accounts that love High Horse, I love them, and we have great relationships, but when you talk about sales, going deep with one account where we have several products that you sell to them, instead of having to go to a different bar to pitch a bottle of High Horse, going to a bar and pitching three different products, I can see that being super beneficial. We've talked about a grapefruit. We've talked about a blue carousel, which I think would be fun. Maybe a spicy triple sec, but we're still working on market penetration. I don't think High Horse has enough awareness to where it makes sense yet.
Sure. All right, let's talk about the sauce. So I have to confess, this past weekend, I was watching a Longhorn football game, and they did particularly well in the first quarter. And I thought, why not just pour some sauce? And so I got a couple ice cubes and put some High Horse on it and thoroughly enjoyed it and may have even had a second glass of it. What's the thought process behind the product itself and how does it appeal to consumers?
So, you know, we talk about what's been hard, you know, what's been easy with this. One of the hardest things is educating people on what triple sec is. Most people think of it as a cheap liqueur that just goes in margaritas. And what blows me away and what I try to tell people is, like, you know, if you go out and spend $60 on a nice bottle of tequila and make a margarita with cheap triple sec, you're making an average cocktail. You're going to bring down that tequila. So every element of that drink should be as good as possible, meaning use fresh lime juice and a good tequila and a good triple sec, a good orange liqueur. And just because it's Cointreau doesn't mean it's great. There are other flavor profiles for just like tequilas where, you know, a Blanco can have, line up five different Blanco tequilas and they can taste different. So can that orange liqueur or triple sec. So for me, when I thought premium, I was like, I want to be 80 proof, just like Cointreau and Grand Marnier. I want it to be natural orange flavor, so made from oranges, and then cane sugar. And I don't want a lot of extra stuff in there. Some people will taste it. They're like, is there vanilla in there? And I'm like, no, there's no added flavors or anything like that. I think the vanilla comes from the mix of sugar and orange flavors. But I want it to be clean and balanced and on the drier side, where I think a traditional triple sec should be, because I think part of why ranch waters have become so popular is that people shy away from, like, the super sweet margaritas. And part of a super sweet margarita is a super sweet triple sec. So I wanted something drier to make more of a skinny margarita vibe.
All right, grand finale question I ask everybody. You come from such a unique perspective in the distillery industry, but what's an issue for the Texas distillery industry that nobody's talking about but should be?
Well, I don't know if nobody's talking about it, but my first gut reaction would be the saturation of so many brands, especially like in tequila and vodka and whiskey. Like, there's a lot of brands trying to be the next Tito's. And it's tough, especially with vodka, because there's not a lot of ways to differentiate yourself. And I don't think contract bottling is to blame for that, but, like, it's getting a little easier to start your own brand where you do not have to build a distillery. You don't have to spend millions of dollars to build a distillery. And it'll take time for some of those to flush out, and some of those won't make it. But the strong brands that are good and are out there driving awareness and building relationships will last. But I know it's tough for liquor stores, and it's tough to go out and try to sell something. Like, I see the fatigue with some of the accounts. They're like, I don't have any more time for reps today. And I, like, totally understand. And so you have to get creative on how you reach out to accounts. Social media has been great for High Horse, not just getting the awareness out there, but, like, building, like, I post stuff a lot about our accounts, like videos of the bartenders, pictures of the bartenders, other specials, food, drinks, or whatever. And other accounts see that. And I've gotten accounts that reached out through social media and been like, hey, we like what you're doing. Can you bring a sample by? We'd love to talk to you, which has been great. The other thing I'll say that no one's talking about, for me, people, like, I have lots of friends and family that see High Horse on social media and me posting new accounts. Like, now we're in here, now we're stuck here. Like, you must be killing it. You're making tons of money. I'm like, no, I'm not making tons of money. Because and I think even more so, like, the key to everything is, like, getting on a menu in a restaurant. It's got to be on a menu item so that they're using it every day. So if you go look at a place with a big back bar, tons of tequilas, if people aren't asking for those tequilas specifically and they're not on the menu, then they're not moving.
They're collecting dust.
They're collecting dust. And even with High Horse, it's a $20 bottle retail. So if it sits on a back bar, it's great that they brought it in and I will support them, but it's not necessarily a moneymaker. it's great brand awareness and I love having those accounts, but that's not what's paying the bills. So I think that's the misconception that people have, is that once you land all these accounts, you're just making money. The other thing that I didn't know until I got into this, like I thought once I sold into an account, you know, I can move on to building more accounts. And I found that I'd spend just as much time with the accounts I have than I do trying to build new accounts because of one, turnover, bars and restaurants, new bar managers, new bartenders all the time. And your brand is quickly forgotten if you're not top of mind. So you have to stay on top of them. Not in a bad way, but it works out great. The relationship gets stronger if you're there more and you're checking in, but also just keeping top of mind so that when they have events, they have parties, they think of you as like, hey, let's use High Horse. Let's, you know, build a drink around this.
Look, I think saturation in the distillery industry in Texas certainly is an issue. Way to get around that is to differentiate. I think it's fair to say that High Horse Triple Sec has done just that. Jeremiah Allen, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.